Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with yesterday's apparent attempt by Republican senators in the Comey hearing to make the case that there is no evidence of connection or collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians, even though today before the House Intelligence Committee, Comey and the head of the NSA gave secret testimony about the further extent of proven Russian interference in our elections directed by Putin to help elect Trump. James Henry, an investigative economist and lawyer who is a global justice fellow at Yale and co-founder with David K. Johnston of DCReports.org, joins us to discuss how the opposite is true to what Senator Grassley tried to dismiss as the disproven Steele dossier. In fact, the Steele dossier continues to be proven factual by press investigations, and presumably inside the intelligence agencies, there is even more supporting evidence that has yet to come out. We'll also look into the just-released Dutch investigative documentary that reveals connections between Giuliani, kleptocrats in the former Soviet Union, and Trump. Then we'll examine the passage today in the House of the second attempt to repeal and replace Obamacare on a vote of 217-213, with 20 Republicans voting against it. A leading authority on the policies of health care and health care reform, Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, joins us. We'll discuss the passage of what is essentially a tax cut bill, which has nothing to do with health care reform since it punishes the poor by cutting Medicaid in order to make up for a tax cut for the rich. And while conservatives argue Americans have no right to health care, there is a right not to die in the street and to get emergency care treatment, which is the least effective and most expensive form of health care. Then finally, with Jerry Falwell Jr. proclaiming on this National Day of Prayer that, quote, "I think evangelicals have found their dream president," we will speak with Diane Winston, who holds the Knight Chair in Media and Religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and publisher of Religion Dispatches. She joins us to discuss today's Rose Garden signing ceremony by President Trump of an executive order weakening the Johnson Amendment that separated church and state, so that now evangelical pastors can endorse or oppose political candidates from the pulpit. And joining us now is James Henry, an investigative economist and lawyer who has written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking. The author of Blood Bankers. He's a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center on Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale, and a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network, and co-founder with David K. Johnston of DCReports.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
And yesterday in the hearings of FBI Director James Comey before the Senate Judiciary Committee, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Charles Grassley, clearly was going out of his way to debunk the Steele dossier, which is the basis of a lot of the charges, indicating that there was collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. And he basically said it's all unproven. It's all been actually said it's been disproven. He mentioned BuzzFeed and how terrible they were, and by publishing this thing and what a piece of trash it was. And then Senator Graham, he tried to make a connection between Fusion GPS and a former Russian counterintelligence agent named Rinat Akhmashtin. And in general, it looks to me like the Republicans, their new strategy is to try and discredit what little we know so far about these connections between the Russians and Trump and his campaign. And this is, of course, ironic, given that today Comey and the head of the NSA are testifying in secret before the House Intelligence Committee, where I'm sure there's an awful lot more that we don't know about being discussed. So let's begin with the premise. Do you think that this is the new Republican strategy that was revealed yesterday by Senators Grassley and Lindsey Graham, that they're trying to discredit what we know so far about these Russian connections?
I don't think it's a new Republican strategy. I mean, we've seen the House Intelligence Committee sort of stalling and then cooperating with the White House and trying to shut this down. The Senate side, had higher expectations, but it seems like they're also going to stonewall this as well. Look, there's a couple different theories here. One is the theory of the case that this election was stolen, that there was a active conspiracy between Trump and Putin. A second aspect of that is that the players like Michael Flynn and Manafort were deeply involved in coordinating things with Russia. I call that kind of the Putin mole theory or the conspiracy theory. There's another whole elephant in the hallway, which has basically gone kind of understudied by all of the committees that are meeting on this. I hope the FBI gets into it. But, you know, there's the Rosneft deal is one thing that they are certainly looking at. And I don't think by any stretch of the imagination that that is disproved. I just meeting today with a BBC journalist who's got a 500-page document about that transaction. And there's a lot of issues about what Qatar's relationship is with the sovereign wealth funds around the world. They were an investor there. They've also played an unusual role in other some of the other players involved in this story, like Iceland. But the big elephant in the hallway here is Trump's criminality and his systematic involvement over decades, really, in all kinds of dodgy deals that basically amount to a kind of money laundering. The Trump Soho, $380 million tower in Manhattan, Trump Tower in Toronto, the Panama Ocean Club, just a long series of these projects, which, you know, Trump isn't investing in Russia. That's not the issue. But he's attracted a lot of money from the former Soviet Union, countries like Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan, the Baku Tower, where he had an oligarch with shady money involved in the project. In all of these cases, we see the same pattern, kind of dodgy flight capital coming out of Russia and the former Soviet Union states, not being very discriminating, and then ending up in these failed projects in New York, where Trump seems to make money. But, you know, as of 2000, he was basically unfinanceable. You know, real estate deals, developers live on mortgages. But he couldn't get any major bank to finance him because he'd had six bankruptcies in the 1990s. He had to turn to Russian and former Soviet Union flight capital and money laundering. And that is, I think, the untold story here in this investigation. Yesterday, we had Dutch TV air a very interesting documentary, which established that Rudy Giuliani's law firm, Bracewell and Giuliani, she joined in 2005, have been involved in setting up companies in the Netherlands that were joint ventures between a Kazakhstan kleptocrat who's hiding out in Switzerland and Bayrock, which was Donald Trump's biggest partner in the Trump Soho project. You know, there's channeling lots of money from New York back to, you know, to the Netherlands, where it was being basically disappeared. So, you know, this is a transaction that we need to investigate, but it's very odd that Giuliani was involved in setting up this kind of deal in 2007 before this kleptocrat fled the coup. So I think there's more and more evidence that Donald Trump may well have known that some of the business partners he was dealing with were actually Russian mobsters or Kazakh kleptocrats, and that there was, you know, proceeds of illegal activity that was being laundered or transacted through his business enterprises. That may, in fact, be the reason why we haven't been able to see his tax returns, because I think it would probably disclose some of these offshore venture partners.
And again, I'm speaking with James Henrys, investigative economist and lawyer who's written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking, the author of Blood Bankers. He is the senior fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale, a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network, and co-founder with David K. Johnston of DC Reports. So what I find extraordinary, though, about these efforts on the part of Grassley and Senator Lindsey Graham, and I'm sure it will intensify, to suggest that particularly the Steele dossier was bogus. Comey refused to answer it. The FBI actually hired Steele. And now Fusion, of course, was the original company that hired Steele, and he did the dossier, but he never wanted it to go public. He's, in fact, faulted both Fusion and BuzzFeed for releasing the dossier, and he's gone into hiding. But from my understanding, and correct me if I'm not right on this, I thought that many aspects of the Steele dossier had been verified by the press. And it's worth noting that all the major news organizations like the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, etc., the Guardian, they're putting a lot of people on this Russian story. And they're finding a lot of stuff that's in that dossier that's actually proven to be correct. So do you think the Republicans can sustain a case that this is fake news while they put out their fake news?
I think this question of the Steele memorandum still bears much more investigation, and Comey's response was absolutely right. It's disappointing when you compare this to the Watergate back in the 1970s. You know, we had a more bipartisan kind of committee involved in investigating President Nixon at that point. And I think without that kind of bipartisanship at that point, you would have had a hard time getting to the bottom. I mean, journalists can only do so much of the work here. But in this environment, which you have much more partisan approach, we don't really have that spirit of, you know, so what we really probably need is either an independent prosecutor or, you know, a special investigation that has subpoena power. But right now, the Democrats in the Senate are stuck, as well as in the House, are stuck with any kind of, without any kind of subpoena power that would be necessary to produce the kind of revelatory testimony that we had with, you know, John Dean or Alexander Butterworth back in the 1973. So that's kind of where we are. I think the Rosneft transaction mentioned in the Steele memorandum, you know, bears further investigation. Some of the contentions about compromise and, you know, videos. I mean, you know, that's an allegation that I don't think Steele pretended to, you know, be a substitute for actual hard proof. But a lot of the elements and details of the Steele memorandum have actually held up pretty well. And most, you know, many of that's one of the reasons why Senator McCain was taking it seriously as of December, seriously enough to send people to London to meet with Steele and go through the details of it. And, you know, it's premature, really, for the Republicans to simply take this kind of one-sided, frankly, I think, you know, blind-eyed approach to the allegations there and to ignore all these other things that are really ripe for investigation. We've had the Bank of Cyprus story. We've had the revelations about the Kazakhstan oligarchs coming up. You know, we've had the story about Iceland and its involvement in financing these Trump deals. You know, there's a growing body of evidence that really cries out for a subpoena power independent investigation at the federal level of these allegations. And if we don't have that, frankly, I think it's going to be a real opportunity missed for the United States to clean up its system and make sure we don't follow Russia into the kind of oligarchy of the future.
But Jim, just the other day, the Senate Intelligence Committee members went across in a bus to the CIA and were taken into the inner sanctum to look at whatever the smoking gun that the CIA has on Trump and the campaign and the Russians. And then today, as I mentioned, Comey and Admiral Rogers, the head of the NSA, are testifying in secret before this committee that Nunes is now been moved aside, and obviously he didn't, you know, he certainly slowed things down, and we know that Senator Burr is slow walking the Senate committee. So here you have this bizarre situation where there's an awful lot of stuff that we don't know about that committees know that are sworn to secrecy, and that's kind of pointless, isn't it? You know, why they're keeping the stuff inside and they can't say anything in public about it. And here we are with all these investigative journalists working around on the edges trying to get into this story. And meanwhile, the Republicans are now trying to say, oh, there's nothing there. I mean, this...
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think what you're going to have is the story is really going to bifurcate into two things. One is all the classified aspects of this conspiracy theory that, you know, is being tested in Washington right now. The other thing that's hiding in plain view, as I've said, is the story about Trump's involvement in money laundering and racketeering in his projects, and dating back to at least 2003, involving former Soviet Union and Russian money. And that is a story that really can be told. And, you know, there's a lot of litigation going on in New York courts right now to get rid of some of the restrictions on having documents that have come to light but are under seal in the Second Circuit in New York, you know, with respect to a particular project called Bayrock. That's just one case that I think will be revelatory and will come to light in the next few weeks once these lawsuits work their way through the system. So
didn't you say that the Dutch have come out with this documentary that was just aired yesterday that makes connections between some kleptocrats in the FSU and Bayrock?
The particular guy there is a fellow named Viktor Kraponov, and he is basically on the lam from Kazakhstan. He was the former mayor of Almaty, and allegedly, he's subject of an Interpol warrant, accused of looting up to $300 million from Kazakhstan, possibly more. But he was in this Dutch documentary, according to this documentary just came out yesterday, and I have a disclaimer to say I'm in the documentary, but basically reveals that Giuliani's law firm was setting up companies for this guy in conjunction with the Russian mobsters who were running Bayrock as Trump's business partners. And so that's a documentary everyone should take a look at, and the U.S. Senate should be taking a look at it as well, because if it's correct, we have some really precise examples of dirty money being laundered through Trump-related business enterprises. These happen to be in the Netherlands. The sequel to this will be broadcast next week, and that's going to talk about another set of players involved with the diamond industry that are also doing dodgy deals with Trump. So there's an increasing amount of support, I think, for the criminal side of this president's behavior with respect to just, you know, organized crime, as opposed to the other kind of crime involved with the election rigging and the whatever he was doing in conjunction with the Putin team. You know, it may be that right now we see Putin actually having a buyer regret here. He has this fellow in office who's chaotic in terms of his policies from one day to the next. He's changing his mind. He's bombing Syria, and then he's making overtures, and Tillerson is renouncing U.S. values as the basis of politics. I mean, it's been a chaotic 4 months of this president. But, you know, so I think President Putin is seeing European governments now beginning to raise their spending on military expenditures to 2% of GDP. That's clearly not something that Putin would probably want to welcome, but he sees Trump supporting that. So, you know, the issue is, apart from the conspiracy, there's a strong track record of this president being willing to turn a blind eye to being involved in business with all kinds of shady characters and basically having no principles at all with respect to his business enterprises. And that's, I think, the clearest thing we can say. Whether that's ever amounts to an impeachable offense, it's certainly something that's worth the attention of the U.S. Senate, U.S. Congress, and of the U.S. electorate.
Well, Trump's biographer of Art of the Deal said that Trump has no moral compass. But just to touch on what you mentioned, the sequel to this Dutch documentary that came out last night or yesterday involves dealings with Trump and the diamond trade. Isn't Jared Kushner, the New York Times just revealed that Jared Kushner's family money was tied up with these Israeli diamond merchants?
Yes, I believe that's true. But I'm not going to steal the thunder from the Dutch TV team.
Yeah, we'll wait and see. Yeah.
But one of the odd things here is that the very best documentary films on this subject are being made entirely in Europe by the Dutch, the Germans, the BBC. We have had, ABC News, I was told, had this whole story about Trump's involvement in Bayrock in 2015. But the head of Disney said, Trump is pretty good for ratings. And CBS 60 Minutes, which turned down the Panama Papers and, you know, has basically done nothing about this. And I'm told a producer there got a similar message about, no, we really don't want to take on Donald Trump in this way. So, you know, there's a real disappointment factor here with respect to the quality of U.S. investigative journalism when it comes to broadcast documentaries and Donald Trump. And I think that that's an issue for the mainstream media to account for. But I'm anticipating there's an awful lot more print journalists working this story, and over the next 3 months, we're going to get to the bottom of it.
Well, James Henry, from your lips to God's ear, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry, an investigative economist and lawyer who has written widely about offshore and onshore tax havens, kleptocracy, and pirate banking, the author of Blood Bankers. He is a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center on Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale University, and a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network, and co-founder with David K. Johnson of DCReport.org. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining today's second attempt to repeal and replace Obamacare.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Spend another lonesome day. I don't wanna die in the hospital. You gotta take me back outside. They don't let you smoke and you can't get drunk. All there is to watch are these soap operas. I don't wanna die in the hospital. You gotta take me back outside. Can you get this tube out of my arm? Morphing in my blood like a slow sex.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jonathan Oberlander, who's a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science. A leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform, he's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, now in its second edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Oberlander.
Thanks so much for having me.
And finally, the House Republicans have passed their repeal and replacement of Obamacare. And frankly, it looks more like they're trying to help out Donald Trump than help themselves. Nancy Pelosi saying that they're going to have this tattooed on their forehead. This is it's going to really hurt them in the midterms. So what do you think is driving this thing? Because we know it's going to be dead on arrival in the Senate. So am I correct in suggesting that maybe this is to help Trump get off the hook, to make it look like he can get something done?
Well, there's no question that President Trump wanted to show that he could get a health reform repeal bill through the House. And more than that, I think Speaker Ryan as well. It was a huge defeat for both of them when so quickly the Republican effort to pass their version of health reform imploded in March, and to sort of have this comeback and get it through the House is at least a short-term political victory. But I think it's one that they may, at least in the House, regret in the long term. And frankly, probably the best political protection for the House is the United States Senate, because if the Senate actually passed this or anything that looked like this and this went into effect, it would be a political disaster for the Republican Party.
So what do you think then is the battle line here? Because we're told that the moderates and the Tea Party were at odds. And in terms of sausage making, what happened there? How did they placate the Tea Party, who are ideologues like Ryan himself is, who don't seem to care about health care? They just want austerity. And then you've got the more moderate, not that they're anything but an endangered species. They were more cognizant of blowback in re-election. So are those the dynamics?
Well, I think one major change is if you look back at why the bill failed originally in March, a major reason is they could not get the House Freedom Caucus, the several dozen very conservative members, of the House of Representatives, and they moved the bill to the right and made changes in the bill that grant states the ability to opt out of Obamacare regulations and so forth. And that was attractive to the conservatives. And so they got many more of those folks to vote for the bill. I haven't actually had a chance to look at the vote count today. And so it'll be interesting to see how many of the less conservative, shall we say, I think is a better term than moderate, members of the Republican caucus voted for this. But by moving the bill to the right, they went to where part of the center of gravity is for the Republican Party in the House right now.
But at the end of the day, from what I can tell from both versions, what this bill is really about is a tax cut for the rich.
I think that's largely true. This, I mean, this is not a viable health care bill. The emperor has no clothes. This is, you know, 7 years of talking about repealing and replacing Obamacare, and you come up with a bill that the Congressional Budget Office initially forecast 24 million people would lose insurance under this bill. We don't know what the forecast will be for the modified bill they just passed, because they voted on it before they got the forecast, which is really quite extraordinary and also quite expedient, because that forecast is likely to be very negative as well. But let's not forget that the Affordable Care Act is a redistributive bill. It finances access to health insurance for Americans who have modest means by, in large part, taxing Americans who are wealthy. And the Republican bill does the reverse. It finances tax cuts for wealthy Americans by cutting health insurance for low-income Americans. So this is truly a reverse Robin Hood in action.
So that is, in effect, the bottom line, right? This is not a health care bill. This is a tax cut bill.
This is a tax cut bill that also has some quite impactful changes in health care. I mean, what it does to Medicaid is enormously important and would be enormously damaging. But there's no question that Republicans are committed to tax cuts and believe in them. And you know, you have to ask the question, why is it that they cut so much money out of Medicaid, which had nothing per se to do with the Affordable Care Act? Why do you cut almost $900 billion over 10 years out of Medicaid? Well, a big part of the reason is they needed to pay for their tax cuts. And the tax cuts are worth to the wealthier, and as well as to the health insurance industry, are worth enough to them that they're willing to cut health care for poor Americans.
So let's turn a little bit then to the idea that it's going to die in the Senate, which led you to suggest, Jonathan, that maybe this whole thing is a charade. I mean, is that what you're suggesting?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, Washington is full of performances. Its chances of getting through the Senate in its current form are zero. There is no way on earth that the United States Senate, with a number of Republican senators representing states that have expanded Medicaid, for example, Ohio and Rob Portman, there's no way in the world that they are going to vote to block grant Medicaid while cutting $900 billion out of it. That is a non-starter. And I think there are other provisions that are non-starters in the Senate as well. So if we're talking about this particular bill cannot pass the Senate. The more difficult question is, could a majority in the Senate agree on an alternative repeal and replace bill that was more moderate and that could get just enough Republicans to clear the bar in the Senate? Could they do that? It's not going to be easy. They're going to have all healthcare system stakeholders aligned against them, the AMA, the Hospital Association, AARP, March of Dimes, American Cancer Society, just about everybody is going to be against this. But can they come up with a more moderate bill, a bill that isn't as devastating as the House bill? And can they get a majority for that? And then the further question is, if they somehow can do that, if they somehow can get a slim majority to pass a less damaging Republican replace bill, what happens then when you have to go back to the House? And you had all these conservatives who joined on only because this bill became more conservative, and then it becomes less conservative in the Senate. So I think those are the questions. But, you know, one way of reading the House is a lot of people who voted for this bill today did not like the bill. They did not like it. It was either too conservative or not conservative enough. They voted for it anyway, and that's partly because they disliked the Senate more. And so they thought, let's just kick the problem onto the Senate and leave it to them.
But if you accept the premise that this is getting both Trump off the hook and Ryan off the hook, in the sense that the first one blew up in their faces, from Trump's point of view, how much is this just the extraordinary unreality of everything he says? I mean, he makes, on the campaign trail, he made these promises about repealing and replacing Obamacare. You're going to have better insurance. It's going to be cheaper. You're going to get more for your buck. You're going to get, everything's going to be covered, pre-existing conditions. Kids under 26 will stay on their parents' insurance, et cetera, et cetera. It'll be cheaper, your premiums will go down, and you'll get better coverage. I mean, this exercise has shown the complete unreality of that. This is an exercise in how to make it worse, not better.
Yes. I mean, and this is back to the point that the emperor has no clothes. Republicans at the moment in Congress do not have a viable replace plan, and they just passed something that would devastate health insurance coverage in this country. And that's because they are not able to agree amongst themselves on the kind of things that are necessary to create a viable plan, which involves subsidies for low-income Americans, regulation of insurance companies, et cetera. Instead, what they have passed is a plan that would re-legalize insurer discrimination. And we shouldn't skip over this, that one of Obamacare's great achievements was outlawing the ability of insurance companies to discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions. I know that Jimmy Kimmel's video this week made a huge impact on a lot of people. This bill will allow states that want to do it to re-legalize discrimination by insurance companies. So while I think in the short run this is a victory for President Trump and Speaker Ryan, and they can say they got something done, got something through the House, and it probably helps politically members in very conservative districts some of whose constituents were upset that they weren't doing anything, I'm not convinced in the longer run that it's going to be a victory, because one of two things is going to happen. Either this is going to fail in the Senate, and then they won't have gotten it done, or something is going to pass the Senate, and if it then passes the House, go into effect. And that is very likely to erode health insurance coverage in this country. And I think that in 2018 or 2020 or both, that could be very bad news for Republicans.
So what explains this whole extraordinary exercise where you basically undo a rather timid and inadequate effort to make things better in terms of us having the worst outcomes for the most money of any country in the world when it comes to health care? Obama didn't feel that it was politically viable or possible to go the single-payer route. He went with the insurance companies. He sort of bribed them by subsidizing new customers, brought them in. Some of them have dropped out. There is obviously a great potential to sabotage the Affordable Care Act, even as it exists, without the Republicans just taking this meat cleaver as they have. But I'm just surprised that people aren't seeing it in the real context as we've discussed. One, it's had nothing to do with healthcare, at least nominally. It was about healthcare, but really it's a tax cut. And two, really smoking out these ideologues. What are they trying to do? What are the Ryans and the Ayn Rand followers trying to do here? At the end of the day, why don't we challenge them to say, what do you do in this country? Because as far as I understand, it's still a law in the United States that if you're about to drop dead, you can still go to an emergency room and get treatment, and that'll cost the taxpayers an awful lot. So are they prepared at the end of the day to step over dying people in the streets? Why doesn't somebody ask them that question?
Well, let's remember that the public opinion polls were not very favorable on the early version of this. We'll have to see what they say now, but the most Americans did not support the Republican plan that imploded in March, and this plan has even more elements that will be controversial. There is a partisan divide, of course, on healthcare reform between Democrats and Republicans in public opinion, but this is not polled well. I think that the Affordable Care Act is imperfect. It has a lot of flaws, but it is incontestable that it has given protections to people who had pre-existing conditions. It is incontestable that 20 million Americans have gained insurance coverage. And any effort to repeal and replace it should have to answer the question, what are you going to do? What is your answer? What is the impact of your plan going to be on all those working Americans who don't have access to health insurance? What are you going to do about them? And anybody who's for repeal and for replace and for this bill that just passed should have to answer that question that Jimmy Kimmel posed, which is, what do you tell families who have children born, who have very difficult medical circumstances and are essentially born with a pre-existing medical condition? How are they going to get insurance? And the authors of this current bill cannot answer that question, because if states opt out, in those states, insurers will be able to discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions. And the remedies that they have for that, high-risk pools and so forth, will not be sufficient. I think the other thing that this episode really highlights is one of the reasons Republicans have had a problem stitching together a viable health care plan is they had a viable health care plan, and it's called the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act, in large measure, represents what Republicans used to support. You saw it in Massachusetts with Governor Romney, an individual mandate, tax credits, private health insurance. Since then, the Republican Party in Congress has moved to the right, moved to a more libertarian perspective. And when you move to the right of where the Affordable Care Act is, then the question is, how do you come up with a viable plan that actually addresses Americans' health insurance needs? And the answer so far is they can't.
But when people like Congressman Raul Labrador and Senators Rand Paul, Mike Lee and Ted Cruz, etc., I mean, I think it was Labrador who said and got roundly booed at a town hall meeting, and he said that, you know, there is no right to health care. It's simply not a right. So if you take the premise that the one right that you have in law in this country is that you can go to an emergency room if you're in critical condition, maybe too late, and it often is, and it's incredibly expensive. So that, to me, is really the question that they should be asked. At the end of the day, what kind of America do you want? Are you basically going to say you don't have any rights and your last recourse is the emergency room, which seems to be the least efficient uses of public resources? Why not challenge them with that?
I think you will hear people challenge them on that. I mean, the House didn't really hold a debate on this. I mean, there really weren't full hearings. There wasn't much of a debate. They didn't wait for the Congressional Budget Office to score this because, in part, they knew that when those estimates come out, they're not going to be favorable to the bill. The Senate is a slower, more deliberative body. I think you're going to hear that debate. I think you will hear people challenge them on moral principle. And I believe that some Republican senators are simply not going to be comfortable with what the House passed. And in fact, their moral compass is going to tell them, we can't do this to Medicaid. We can't increase the uninsured population in this country by 24 million people. And that's why I think the chances of this getting through the Senate as is are simply zero.
Right. But it's not just moral, it's practical, isn't it? It's so much cheaper. Preventative medicine is so much cheaper than a last-ditch effort when it's too late. And that's what I find so extraordinary about...
Well, the U.S. is extraordinary, and we are, as we've discussed before, the most expensive system in the world, and yet the only rich democracy with a large uninsured population. It does not have to be this way. It can be a better healthcare system. I think the Affordable Care Act leaves lots of room for improvement. There are many problems with it, but this is a major step backward and another indication that that issue of is healthcare a right, which has been answered in the affirmative in every other rich democracy, that is still a principle that is deeply contested in the United States.
Well, Jonathan Oberlander, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Oberlander, who's a professor of social medicine, health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science, a leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform. He's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, now in its second edition. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing today's Rose Garden signing ceremony by President Trump of an executive order weakening the separation of church and state so that now evangelicals, pastors can endorse or oppose political candidates from the pulpit. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Diane Winston, who holds the Knight Chair in Media and Religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. She's also the publisher of Religion Dispatches. Welcome to Background Briefing, Diane Winston.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Diane. And today in the Rose Garden, Donald Trump signed an executive order on this National Day of Prayer or National Prayer Day. Last night, there were a number of evangelical leaders in the White House, 45 pastors to be exact, celebrating religious liberty in advance of the signing today. And the signing today, of course, was the removal of the Johnson Amendment, which in 1954 effectively barred pastors, evangelicals, ministers, etc., from endorsing or opposing candidates from the pulpit. So let's start with that. How significant is this? Because it seems like we've been on a slippery slope for some time where so much of evangelical politics or evangelical preaching in this country seems to me like a front for right-wing politics.
Well, Ian, first of all, just to be precise about it, Trump did not remove the Johnson Amendment. Only Congress could do that. What he did was he told the IRS to go easy on those religious institutions that may seem to infringe upon it. And the Johnson Amendment basically says that religious institutions that are tax exempt cannot endorse or oppose candidates. It does not say that they can't support positions or they can't do political education or they can't help with voter registration. It's just about endorsing or opposing candidates. And in fact, the Johnson Amendment really hasn't had much teeth. There have been very few cases where churches have been called to the carpet for or abrogating it. So in a sense, what Trump did was symbolically important. And it shows where he wants to go in terms of supporting evangelical issues. But what he did functionally should not have that much impact on anyone, since the Johnson Amendment wasn't doing that much in the first place. So there's two issues, the symbolic one and the actual one. And that's what's interesting about this. It's good optics, but whether it makes a difference is questionable.
Well, there's no question that the pastors last night and those gathered in the Rose Garden today were very happy with what the president was signing.
Well, you know, as I have read more deeply into some of this, yes, on one level they were happy he was signing it because it looks, as I say, on one level like he's supporting their issues. But a lot of those pastors were hoping that he would come out and do something on transgender issues and on GLBT issues. They're still really angry about gender-free bathrooms and same-sex marriage, and Trump did nothing to address those issues.
Well, his daughter, Ivanka, and Jared were there in attendance, and along with Chief Strategist Stephen Bannon, who is not famous for his religiosity, as far as I know. So I guess that's there, the checks and balances. But what is the relationship then, since this is not really, doesn't have much teeth and only affects the IRS? The IRS, of course, give the 501c3 exemption to churches. How does that impact that, or does it relate to it? Because I recall in very, very few occasions have the IRS ever gone after a church, questioned their nonprofit status. In fact, I recall that a Episcopalian church out in Pasadena was once, I don't know what the word would be, but for the want of a better description, was it?
Right, under suspicion.
Under suspicion, was it? I thought, yeah. And that was because they were preaching sermons against, I think it was against the Iraq War or something,
right,
along those lines. And that itself was pretty unusual. And it did seem somewhat politically loaded at the time. So what is the situation vis-a-vis the connection between what Trump did today and the IRS's so-called policing of church and state issues in terms of tax exemption, which they seem to be pretty lax about in the first place?
Well, that you're exactly right, Ian. The IRS does not go after most churches on this issue. And there have been very, very few cases and even fewer convictions. So that's what I mean by when I say this has very little teeth. What it does do is that ministers, rabbis, imams who have been careful about not coming out and saying, I endorse this candidate, I oppose that candidate, now they can do that. And it's unlikely the IRS will come out after them. So insofar as it opens up a level of expression that they did not claim before, this does make a difference. Interestingly enough, in a Pew poll last year, 71% of Americans opposed the idea of allowing tax-exempt religious organizations to oppose or support political candidates. So it looks like a large part of the country really is not even in favor of what Trump did today. The other thing, though, that he did with this order, which may be more significant, is that he basically told several of the departments, Health and Human Services, Treasury, and Labor, that they should consider changing parts of the Affordable Care Act that allow employers to that prevent employers from not providing contraceptives to their employees. In other words, going back to the Hobby Lobby and Little Sisters, the Little Sisters cases that said we don't want to have to provide contraceptives for our employers if it's against our religious beliefs. Obama's now saying, let's rethink that, and maybe we can find a way to take that out of the Obamacare protection.
Again, I'm speaking with Diane Winston, who holds the Knight Chair in Media and Religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism. She's also the publisher of Religion Dispatches. So, according to the Pew Research Center survey in 2016, 71% of Americans oppose allowing places of worship to endorse political candidates while maintaining their tax-exempt status. And not one religious group favors eliminating the Johnson Amendment. So how did this happen then? Because 1,300 faith leaders opposed this executive order, and yet it happened. So I'll get into who was against it, but who was for it?
Well, the Vice President, Mike Pence, is a strong supporter of religious liberty issues, and this was one of his pet causes. And he supposedly had been pushing for this. This was similar to a bill that he had signed when he was governor of Indiana. So Pence was very much engaged with this issue. Also, there are many evangelical leaders who feel very strongly about this, and even though a broad majority of Americans may not like this idea particularly, a lot of evangelical leaders, especially those who are engaged in politics, do like it a lot because it gives them the ability to say explicitly what they want in front of their congregations. So I'd say that, many evangelicals, especially those leaders who supported Trump, probably were pushing for this along with the vice president.
And in terms of the 1,300 faith leaders who opposed the executive order, they wrote a letter to the White House. And just quoting the letter, the draft executive order flies in the face of that rich diversity by enshrining one religious perspective on marriage, gender, identity, health care, and the roles of houses of worship and partisan politics into law above all others. This is neither what religious freedom means in the eyes of the law, nor what religion itself means to millions of Americans of faith. So they're not listened to? Is that the conclusion?
Well, it's interesting because that draft proposal did address issues, those issues of homosexuality and transgender. Mm-hmm. And
they were dropped, right?
They were dropped, exactly.
Sure.
And that was because there was so much backlash against it. And so the executive order that Trump signed today was watered down from what the administration or members of the administration had originally wanted. I suppose if you went out and talked to the leaders who signed that letter, there'd be a certain sort of pragmatism which would say, we're not happy about this because it still goes a step further in eroding church-state separation than we would want, but it's a lot better than what we had seen a month or two ago. So that's what I mean by saying that the optics and the symbolic nature of this executive order is good for evangelicals, but it's not the win that they had hoped for originally with Trump.
So does that mean that Vice President Pence will fight the battle another day?
Well, the right-wing supporters of Trump who are saying yay to this current development are also saying this is a beginning. This is not an ending. This is a beginning, and they're hoping that as time goes by, they can see other things added to it. You know, these people were not happy with the developments under Obama, which allowed same-sex marriage and gender-neutral bathrooms, and they want to see that gone. And they're probably hoping that this executive order is a first step to getting those other issues taken care of.
Well, Jerry Falwell Jr., the president of Liberty University, where Trump gave the commencement address back in May, he says, I think evangelicals have found their dream president. I've never seen a White House have such close relationship with faith leaders than this one. And of course, if you recall, Diane Winston, when Trump did address at Liberty University, what did he say, 1 or 2 Corinthians? It sounded like mm-hmm. that joke, you know, 2 Corinthians went into a bar, you know. So, again, they must be happy, though, with Gorsuch, right? I mean, if they're not happy that they didn't get the anti-gay and the anti-bathroom stuff that they wanted, they still got Gorsuch, right?
Yes. The evangelical community definitely is experiencing a series of wins under Trump. And whether it's the Supreme Court, whether it's this executive order, it's all looking good. You know, so far nothing dramatic has changed. And it's just a matter of seeing what can be, you know, what the Democrats or what moderate Republicans can do to sort of stand up against some of these Trump initiatives that have the evangelical right wing so enthused.
Well, it is a very strange moment here to have this man being celebrated, one of the pastors, James McDonald, a megachurch pastor of the Harvest Bible Chapel, who served on Trump's Evangelical Advisory Council. He called Trump lecherous and worthless after the Access Hollywood tape came out, but subsequently now has turned around and said how much he's pleased with President Trump's efforts and, quote, the conscientious effort to make good on the campaign promises is very apparent. Only a hardened and cynical person would conclude that he's not trying to keep the campaign promises. So, I mean, going back to the campaign itself, when Pence was chosen as the vice president, my assumption was that that was a way to guarantee the Christian vote, and no Republican presidential candidate could ever get elected without that vote. What's your sense in this context? Did Pence bring them in and guarantee their vote, or were they already predisposed to Trump?
Trump, in many ways, reminds me of Reagan. They both were conservative Republican candidates that, on the surface, would not seem to be a natural fit with the evangelical right community. Reagan was a divorced actor, coming out of Hollywood. You know, Trump, we all are familiar with his various faults. And yet both men captured right-wing and Christian right-wing voters pretty early on in their campaigns because of their positions. Now, when Reagan chose George Bush Sr. as his vice president, evangelicals were really disappointed. They did not see George Bush, the father, as one of their own, and they felt that it was a real betrayal. Trump was smart enough to avoid that same mistake, and instead of choosing someone who the evangelicals would not get behind, he reinforced their support. He showed them he was really their candidate by picking one of them, Mike Pence. So whether Trump consciously learned from Reagan's mistake or whether he was just very shrewd, yes, he had evangelicals in his corner. By choosing Mike Pence, he just sealed the deal. It was a very strategic choice on his part.
And if he is impeached for the for some of the unholy practices that he's being accused of in some of this Russian stuff that's yet to be proved, we could end up with Vice President Pence, our first, would he be our first openly unabashed evangelical president?
Not at all. Jimmy Carter was our
That's
first
true.
Unabashed openly evangelical president. And at the time, Carter got a lot of grief from the media. If you recall, when he said things like he felt lust in his heart and, you know, he was born again, he said many things that spoke directly to his evangelical faith that had a lot of reporters scratching their heads.
Mm-hmm.
And Reagan did not like the term born again, but he did see himself as an evangelical Christian. And George W. Bush most definitely was evangelical.
Yeah.
And Bill Clinton is a Southern Baptist. I don't know whether he claimed to be evangelical or not, but yes, we've had a series of evangelicals in the White House.
So it's not necessarily a big change then in terms of religiosity, even though Mike Pence does seem to be fairly committed, if not intense, in his religious zeal.
Yes, yes, he's more transparent. I mean, George W. Bush was pretty religious. So as an outsider, it's hard to measure who's more religious or who's less religious.
Right.
But Pence is pretty explicit in a way that George W. wasn't always explicit. And Pence seems to really live according to his convictions.
And that includes not having lunch alone with a woman who wasn't his wife, which a lot of people were quite surprised by.
But, you know, a lot of religious people wouldn't have lunch alone with a woman.
Hmm. Well, I guess I'll burn in hell because I've done it. I've done it a few times. I thank you for joining us, Diane Winston.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's a pleasure to talk to you. See
Likewise.
You soon. Bye.
Bye. And again, I've been speaking with Diane Winston, who holds a night chair in media and religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, and is the publisher of Religion Dispatches. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.